Good evening. Welcome to the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast. Enter freely and of your own will. In this episode, you may find many strange things, for the films to be discussed are old, and they have many memories. So, beware. Beware.
Welcome back to the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast, and enjoy part two of our two-part episode on the 1925 classic, The Phantom of the Opera.
So they finally reach the Phantom's lair, and it's this really nice, you know, bachelor pad he's got down at in the bowels of the sewers underneath the underneath, you know, six stories down underneath the thing. Possibly the inspiration for Lex Luthor's pad in Superman the movie. I don't know. We'll see.
Could be.
But she, you know, she's there and she's very terrified, and she runs into, when she realizes he's the Phantom, she tries to sort of escape through these black curtains, and she sees a coffin that's been made into a bed, and he says, That's what keeps me, the phrase is, it keeps me mindful of that other dreamless sleep that cures all ills forever.
Yeah, I know.
I mean,
the Phantom's
definitely of a certain type. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's all about love and everything like that, but he's got that darker side. I will say that one thing I do love about the Phantom is in his more manic moments, not the sad pleading for Christine to love him moments, but the other ones. You know, like the Frankenstein monster is just this mishapen guy who's very tragic, and the Wolfman, you know, Larry Tappet obviously just wants to die. Yeah. You know, Dracula does what he does. The Gill Man's kind of whatever like that. Next to the Invisible Man, I would say the Phantom is the universal monster that most just loves being the Phantom. Like he enjoys kind of being the Phantom. Like he enjoys running around and scaring everybody, and he enjoys like his little black rimmed letters and, you know, all that fun stuff. It's really funny.
It, right up into the very end, which is I've got a big spiel about that once we get there. But yeah, he takes some almost perverse enjoyment out of knowing that he's the Phantom,
right?
And just
he embraces it. Yeah, he uses his power. And then I love the line where she says, "You are the Phantom," and he says, "If I am the Phantom, it's because man's hatred has made me so."
Yeah.
He says, "I shall be saved, and it will be because of your love that redeems me." So Eric has decided that for one reason or another, Eric's decided that Christine is his means to salvation. He's decided that I think he's fallen in love with her, and I think my interpretation is that he thinks that the fact that she's brought out this positive emotion in him, something besides hatred and vengeance and, you know, ugliness, she's inspired him to be a better person, and he thinks therefore that she's a means to his thing. So he loves her. He definitely loves her, but again, it's that thing I talk about with a lot of these characters in this era of you know, writing, where he wants something out of her though too, like, right? He wants his own salvation from her. He wants her to give him that by loving him. So while he does love her, it's not totally altruistic, right? He's got an agenda. It's interesting. It's a little muddled.
Yeah. I mean, he's definitely taking the idea of her, or the image of her, I guess in his case, the sound of her, and kind of based his infatuation on that. And
right.
And so that's how he acts accordingly. And, you know, And this is the part where the character is a little bit relatable, because if, you know, anyone's been the guy on the sidelines that's, you know, had a fascination with this beautiful person that they're never going to be able to to do anything with, then it's easy to let your mind kind of create this fantasy of, you know, if what would happen if she was with me or if they were with me, and what would I do and what would that love do for me? And that's kind of what, to me anyways, that's what that Genesis is. And I will say,
that makes sense.
In terms of first dates, Eric sets the bar kind of high. Cause you know, it's, he get
horseback
alone, ride,
right?
Gondola ride.
Yeah.
You know,
I know he's very romantic. If he just had like a pizza waiting for her, right? It'd be great.
Netflix.
Yeah. Let's watch some stuff. Christine, it's too much for Christine and she passes out for the second time in 2 days. There might be a corset issue going on here. I'm not sure. She just can't breathe right. He picks her up and he carries her into another bedroom. So he's kind of got like a 2-bedroom suite. Hers is beautiful. It's like the bedroom of a princess, and there's a huge bed that's ornately carved to be like the prow of a ship, which I found out in IMDb's trivia section was also used as Norman Desmond's bed in Sunset Boulevard.
Oh,
so
wow.
They reused it. There you go. Yeah. Pops up. And I've seen that and I never made the connection, but yeah. He's got her apartment in typical kind of stalker fashion. I wanted to know when she wakes up, she sees like he has all these shoes laid out for her. He knows her shoe size. He's got all these dresses laid out. He knows her sizes and stuff. It does get a little creepy. You're like, ew, yeah, there's a stalkery thing going on there. Anyway. Paris is all in an uproar and the newspapers are all talking about how, you know, Christine Day's disappeared. There was obviously the chandelier disaster and stuff. In other versions of the story, the opera is closed, and I assume it's closed at this point too, except that they decided to do this one more performance. And you know, the B story where the managers who just bought this house, now there's been like a disaster and someone was killed and their lead singers is missing. In the 43 version, he kills Carlotta, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
The Phantom actually kills her. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Vandermaid. You
know, there's that. Yeah. So anyway, as I said, anger management for a second. So yeah, the Phantom actually does need some anger management therapy. That's for sure. We're back to the prefect's office and this idea of Ledoux is on the trail of the Phantom, and he does have an idea of who he is, and he presents him with a card. It's like an information card about who the Phantom is, and it reads, "Born during the Boulevard Massacre," which was part of one of the revolutions where it's kind of like the Kent State where the militia or the National Guard fired on people and killed a bunch of people during the revolution, unarmed people. Self-educated musician and master of black art, exiled to Devil's Island for criminal insane, escaped now at large. And it has, you know, Eric at the top. Like that's the legend. So the authorities to some degree do know what they're dealing with. They just are not sure, you know, how to deal with it and how they're going to. Meanwhile, Raul's getting more and more frustrated because they're not doing anything to him. Now, Raul he's a vicomte, which is like a vice count. So it's an interesting thing in the story because he's basically nobility. And in the film, he dresses almost like he's in the military of some kind. So I assume he's got some official thing because we're in an era in Paris where being of a noble, whatever, would not have mattered. Because the revolution is gone and done, and they've done away with most of the actual nobility. Actually, done away with them.
Yeah.
Guillotine them to some degree. So I don't know. But he is someone who like seems to like when the guy at Christine's door tries to stop him, he just pushes past him, and he just seems to march into the police's thing and yell at them and stuff. So he's definitely a man who commands a certain amount of, you know, authority. So you can imagine, like you were saying, Livia, like you can imagine being the Phantom and going like, dude, I'm deformed and I live in the basement. This guy's tall and handsome and he's like the boss of things. Like, what am I going to do? Like, you know, I've got a kidnapper, right?
Right.
Like, I can't compete with that. It's like he's the captain of the football team. He's like, I can't compete with that. Come on. It's not fair. So again, Christine wakes up the next day. And she finds like all these dresses and things. So the Phantom is prepared. Like, he wants her to live down here with him. Like, this is going to be a thing. They're just going to live down here and be happy. He's going to play for her. He is ridden. And then this is important in all the versions of the story. The Phantom's written an opera called Don Juan Triumphant. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of written it for Christine, as a thing. And obviously this is the version of his opera that in the Claude Rains version, he submits and gets rejected. And then, you know, all the thing happens with the acid at the place and all that stuff. He's playing music and he gives her a message, and it's again, this whole thing where it's, you know, dear Christine, you're in no peril. As long as you don't touch the mask. So again, it's like you're saying, it's the setup. Like, okay, as long as she doesn't touch the masks, everything's fine. Sure enough, she walks out there. He's playing piano, and she just starts walking up to him. And they take their time with it. She walks up, and she's behind him, and she's thinking about it. And she decides maybe it's not a good idea. She gets closer. She almost does it. She does. You know, I mean, they really milk it. It's good stuff.
It is. It's shot so well, and you know, it's. There's so much of a buildup because, I mean, you know it's going to happen, you know.
Of course,
yeah. Like you said, yeah. As soon as you said, you know, just don't touch my mask, you know.
And I would argue even if you don't, if you haven't seen this movie, you know of that moment. That's, I mean, it's the moment in the movie where she unmasks it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she finally does. And we have this great shot where she just reaches up, pulls off the mask, and we see his makeup. So, the elements that we know for sure of what Chaney did for the makeup is he wore a bald head wig. So it's a prosthetic thing because Chaney had hair, but he wears this thing that's like a skull cap, and it was raised. So it made his forehead like extra tall and bony. And he had this very lank, it's like a, you know, male pattern baldness thing hanging down around it, from underneath. He built fake cheekbones up with cotton and collodion, which is like an alcohol-based thing, which I will tell you, like, I've used kind of stuff like this, and I talk about this a lot. Like, that stuff will irritate the heck out of your eyes. It's and if it's right next to your eyes, like, you know, around your skull, your eye sockets and stuff, geez, oh, man, not fun. But that gives his face the cheekbones, like the occipital bones, the protrusion, like we see nowadays. Like you see this in like, I mean, you can go to and get like a decent makeup appliance at like a Spirit Halloween store that gives you those, like the raised forehead and yeah. The sunken and the raised cheekbone. And the effect that has is it makes your eyes seem like they go back and they're sunken. And of course he shaded in around his eyes. he wore fake teeth that also had like a dental thing that pried his mouth open, like the sides of his mouth open, so it kind of locked his face in this permanent grimace. He had wires inside his nostrils that stretched out the nostrils to as big as they could, and then another wire that went from there up under a layer of makeup and pulled the front of his nose up into that, the what we sort of know as like a skull nose, like the lack of the, because your skull is all, Your nose is all cartilage and just, you know, flesh, as it goes away. You only have like the base of your nose bone, in your skull, as we've all seen. So, you know, the challenge is, and I talk about this, is like, you're trying to create this idea that, you know, in the book, the description is that the Phantom's face is weathered away. So it's shrunken into like the skull like things, because your skull is inside your face and you have tissue and muscle and, you know, some fat and what have you that builds up the fleshier part of your face and rounds it out. So the problem is that you're Lon Chaney, when you're trying to build a skull on top of your face, there's this danger of your face looking bigger and chubbier rather than smaller. You're trying to achieve this effect where your head is actually smaller, but you're doing it by building outward, and it's a tricky thing to do and to sell and do really well. And obviously here's one of our earliest examples of this being done as well as it could have been given the materials at the time and without any aid of digital effect or anything, you know. It's an incredible piece, and I've never, you know, you see like people replicate makeups, and you see, like, you know, I've seen good versions of the Frankenstein monster at Monsterpalooza, and I've seen, you know, Rick Baker do really good versions of Chaney's makeup in the Wolfman. I don't know if I've ever seen anyone even attempt this makeup to a point where I would have called it successful. It's just it's a moment in film history that, like, who knows? Like, I think, and obviously, as I already said, when they tried to do it in 57, it did not come off.
No. Well, yeah. So, and kind of like we said at the start of the show, I think it's part of the genius of Chaney's makeup, but it's also part of the uniqueness and the reason why you would never see it like this. It's not, I mean, one, the techniques are different, yes, but all of his makeups are made to fit his face. I mean, he understood, yes, his face was a three-dimensional, right, painting, and you know, he can that's what he did. And for it to be recreated, it's never going to look the same because no one has his face. You know, no one has those, yes, those exact features with his exact shape and structure, sure, and all that stuff. And that's what makes his makeup so, to me at least, so incredible, because you can't,
yes,
I mean, in some ways you can, but most of the time you can't tell that it's him. But at the same time, the makeup would only work on his face because it's specifically designed for, absolutely, his features and his face. And it's just,
so the first thing you would need would be someone who looks almost exactly like Lon Chaney, someone who has his almost identical, yeah, bone structure. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's mostly his face showing through. It's not an entire layer of makeup. It's pieces of makeup. And I will say, I mean, I've watched this movie a lot, and I've looked at photos of him a lot. I will say, like, even Chaney was not able to, I think, from day to day to day, get his makeup to look exactly the same every time. There's scenes in the movie where the Phantom does look, he looks a little different, not, mm-hmm, better or worse. He just looks a little different than in other scenes. There are days where his cheekbones look a little angled and sharp, a little more than this first, you know, Bravo scene where we finally see her. So, you know, even Chaney's, because he's not, you know, nowadays you would mold the actor's face in alginate, do a plaster mold, and you would do a negative mold, and you would do a positive plaster cast of the actor's face. So you'd have a perfect structure of the actor's face to build with clay. You build the prosthetic on top of him, then you'd remold that. It's like a 19-step process. Trust me, it's humongously crazy. You would have used foam latex in the old days. Now you use silicone. But the basic thing is you would have that basic skull structure for his face. You'd have like dozens of them ready to go, one per every day. This is how they do Nebula in the Marvel Comics movies. This is how they do everything now. Chaney doesn't have that. He doesn't have a ready-made, you know, grab the next appliance for the next day. He's building this up bit by bit every single day, which, yeah, in addition to being complicated, is time-consuming, is, you know, everything. So I don't know much about how many days he had on set as the Phantom. It had to have been, I mean, he's got a decent amount of screen time as the Phantom, so it has to be at least probably 7, maybe 12. I don't know. Like, I don't know how fast, I actually don't even know how fast this movie was shot.
I'm not sure either. But
I don't know as much about this movie as I do a lot of other Universal movies. I mean, I know a decent amount, obviously, but not as much. But I think also a lot of that information's not as readily known. I mean, some of our listeners probably will help us with that, I would hope.
So
we might know that.
I have the Magic Image film book on the Phantom of the Opera, one of several things I have about the Phantom, and they have
I thought you were going to say memorized at the end of that sentence. I have it memorized, the whole book.
And it was far too big for me to memorize. It take way too much effort on my part, Jim. But they have a section in here totally just dedicated to his makeup, and they actually call out what you were saying, which is the differences in how he looks as the shooting goes on. And they, so I'm not sure if this was intentional or not, but they have some good points, which is his makeup appears to make him appear more unhinged as he loses more of his sanity. So as the movie goes on, from the time where she unmasks him and then, I mean, in a way kind of tricks him and says, okay, I just want to see Raoul one last time, and then I will be yours forever. And of course, he finds out that's not true. Then, you know, like his, like you said, his cheekbones are a little angled. His mouth looks a little bit wider. His teeth look a little changed.
There's little subtle differences. Yeah. I don't know. You know, and also, you know, the lights they're shooting under at this point, you know, especially, but even, you know, as you get into the 30s too, are really hot. And, you know, actors are people. I mean,
they are
generally by the wider definition. Yeah, sure. We'll give them that. No, anyway, but actors are people and they sweat and, you know, they eat food, they bloat out. Things they don't teach you in film school. Like if your actor has a nude scene, film it before lunch. They will really appreciate it. that's something that I didn't know starting out in film. I learned it quickly when I was requested that one time. But then, you know, in Cheney, as the filming goes on, people aren't sleeping as much, you know, they're getting tired or they're getting, you know, more worn down. Time gets crunched. Maybe there's not as much time. You know, maybe there's a day where he doesn't have quite as much time to get into makeup as he wanted to. Who knows? We're speculating a lot at this point because I don't personally have a lot of information about how this shoot went. But yeah, and there's, you know, so, but the makeup also just melts under lighting too. Like, it runs, it changes, and it requires touching up and everything. And then there's the scene where he, in full makeup, goes underwater.
Yeah.
Which I can tell you, if there had been like an actual makeup artist on set, if that had been Jack Pierce doing that makeup, and they're like, okay, here's the scene where he goes underwater, Jack Pierce would have been like, wait, what? Hang on.
Well,
let's discuss this, because that is a huge process of getting made up that will be ruined at that point, because there's no way. He comes out of it. I think that might have been a different day or something like that, because there's no way that water does not absolutely screw up a ton of
paint and everything. There's two pictures. So Cheney actually had tests done of the makeup after going underwater. It's kind of a famous one where he's standing there. He's got his arm kind of bent and out in front of him, and he's squeezing his sleeve, and you see the water dripping down.
Mm-hmm.
He was testing how well the makeup held up going in and out of water. And so, and I have no clue how he mastered this, but he was able to make it waterproof enough for that scene to go under and then come back up
and come back
and
up.
So
that's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, it's just the
only way I can understand that is if his makeup is oil based, which, you know, so it wouldn't react to the water as much, right? It wouldn't be water soluble. But, God, putting oil-based makeup on your skin, it's just, I don't really know.
There's, you know, I think it's widely, you know, known, and he's regarded as the man of a thousand faces, and it's just kind of like, oh, yeah, he did some really good makeup. You know, I'm not sure people today still fully realize the amount of detail and work he put into these characters outside of just acting, because the trial.
And there's, you know, there's. Yeah, I was going to say R&D that goes into
the trial and error just of this, of because I'm sure this wasn't, you know, to your point, it's not like he just put on a mask and he's the Phantom. He's building this on his entire face every day, you know, from scratch. And now he's got to do it to where it's waterproof, and he's taking the time to do it and test it out and get in full costume and taking pictures and shots. And he's a man truly dedicated to what he did. He literally put everything he had into his projects.
And he's carrying the fate of this film on his shoulders. Like, you know, there's a lot of moving parts in this film. There's the spectacle and the scene and the costumes and, you know, obviously the acting and, you know, lighting and everything. But I mean, the Phantom's the one thing that if the Phantom in the Phantom of the Opera doesn't work, if the makeup doesn't look right, you're done. That's the, you know, I mean, that's the one thing that has to work. Everything else you can get away with, you know, here, there, whatever. The Phantom has to look good. And if Phantom doesn't look good, your movie's not going to be received very well. So yeah, he's got a lot of responsibility. So, and he, yeah, obviously took it seriously. So here's, we have the thing where he, you know, she's obviously repulsed by him. But he says, like, to prove his love for her, he's going to let her go. and he's going to have her, let her sing the opera one more time. And then, and then she's one last time. Yeah. And then she's coming down with him, and that's it. And she kind of agrees and she kind of leaves. But I love, he has this moment where, like, you know, I'm sure the family had an idea of how that moment was going to go. And I don't think it went the way exactly he wanted it to. He's kind of like, oh gosh, that just didn't, that could have gone better. We have the masked ball scene, which is, it's again, it's, this is one of my standout scenes in the thing. Now, the version I'm watching is in, this scene is just in black and white. In many versions, it was hand colored. Is it colored on your Blu-ray?
Yeah. So that's
tinted.
It was shot. So the whole, and that's interesting. That's another, I actually found that out today. There's a documentary that Cortland Hull, who's Henry Hull's nephew, had done called Unmasking the Phantom. And I watched it for the first time in quite a while, just to kind of get some more facts as we were about to record. But one of the parts on that documentary talks about this thing that's coming up, this scene where the masquerade ball. And so it was shot intentionally on two-strip Technicolor. So I think that the only...
It was shot two-strip.
Yeah, the only colors were like red and green, so you couldn't necessarily do, I think, like pink or blues or anything like that. And I think most of the colors you see in there are some shade of either red or green or just straight black. And that whole sequence was shot in just, like I said, two-strip Technicolor, and back then it was definitely something like a novelty, you know, something to just kind of, you know, get more people to come to the theater. And but for whatever
expensive, yes, though,
and for whatever reason, whether it was just for smaller theaters or whatnot, some showings and some versions show the whole thing in black and white. And there was apparently some of the ballet scenes that were also shot in, supposedly also shot in the two-strip Technicolor, but were then edited out in one of the many redos of the film. And I know the scene right after this where he's unmasked and he's on top of the Apollo statue and looking down. You can see like the red in his cape and stuff. I think that's like tinted or colored after the fact. I don't think that was.
I think that's post. Okay.
Yeah, I don't think that was. That, shot
that's
that way.
The one. You corrected me. That's the one that was post colored. Yeah. So they would actually go in every cell and paint it in, just like kind of like they would go in and make Lon Chaney's face glow in Man Made Monster, or Boris Karloff's in Invisible Ray. Yeah. But this scene was actually shot in two strip. Wow. Yeah, very expensive time, very, very new technology. They weren't sure exactly whatever. And like you said, it wasn't current Technicolor would be three strip, it'd be red, green, blue. When you combine, you can get any value or shade you need. And that's how you get Gone with the Wind and, you know, everything after. Wizard of Oz. This would be closer to the way they did Mystery of the Wax Museum. The beam is split and projected through the lens and projected on two different pieces of film that are then combined afterwards and stuff. It's super complicated to do back in the day. Just appreciate your iPhone, because wow, that was difficult to do. It was not always that good to do. So this is a huge scene with tons of extras, which is amazing. First of all, that they shot it on a vaguely experimental format. A scene this big and expensive, that's very impressive. The confidence of that is great. In the midst of this, all this, everyone's wearing masks, no one knows who they are, but Raoul and Christine kind of meet up. In the midst of this, the character that calls himself Red Death shows up, and it's the Phantom in this elaborate, he looks kind of like Sean Connery in Highlander. It's just very elaborate, flowing robes and huge hat and stuff. And he's got a skull mask, and he comes in and he, the, little, Florine, the prop guy, comes up to him and he's dressed as like a court jester, and he sends him rolling away. And he says, "Beneath your dancing feet are the tombs of tortured men. Thus does Red Death rebuke your merriment."
Yes.
So he's a bit of a party pooper, but you know,
it's such a great costume that he has there. Just
it's an incredible looking costume. Yeah, I think one of the Sideshow collectibles or somebody does a great statue of him as this character. It's really great looking.
It is Sideshow. I've got it actually. Yeah. It's fell down and broke, but it's been repaired. I just can't move his hands anymore.
That's funny. This is another chilling. There's two kind of creepy moments here where there's a moment where the Red Death's walking up the stairs and Christine and Raoul he looks up and he totally in the midst of the crowd in their masks, the Phantom looks up and spots them from a ways away. Yeah. Like, which is, you know, it just has this idea of like, there's something uncanny about the Phantom. Like a normal person probably wouldn't be able to totally do that. And he pursues them up these stairs as they go up and up and up towards the roof until they finally get to the roof, and they do think they're safe, and they're just up on top by this huge statue of it's like a muse of some kind or something.
I think it's Apollo.
Of the Paris Opera House is it Apollo? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, that makes sense.
So and fun fact, the person who sculpted that huge statue, Charles Gamora.
Yes. Charles Gamora. Mm-hmm. Nice. Good pull. Charles Gamora, who you would have heard Livia and I talk about on Monster and the Girl. He's from the Philippines. He came here as a teenager, stowaway on a ship, was drawing portraits, I believe, outside of Universal, and kind of got discovered and became a prop maker.
Yeah.
And set builder on this, because he was just an immensely talented guy, and then goes on to have this career as, because he was like 5'4", build his own ape suits, and went on, and you know, I would be willing to bet in the classic golden age of cinema, I'd be willing to bet about 40% of the apes you see in movies is probably Charlie Gamora, maybe 30, but a good amount. He did like 40 films as an ape.
Yeah, because I mean, everything from the horror movies, so you know, Murders in the Rue Morgue, The Monster and the Girl, then all Three Stooges, Laurel and Hardy. You know, just anything that.
Yeah, Bob Hope, I think. Yeah, I know. Like,
some sci-fi characters towards the 50s, like Colossal.
He did some sci-fi stuff towards the end. Yeah, I can't remember which one it was. He's one of the creatures in one of the more important 50s sci-fi movies and stuff. I think he was not quite as agile towards the 40s and 50s, because even in we said in Monster and the Girl, he's in the ape suit in the close-ups, but not when he's swinging from branches and stuff. So because obviously this is 1925 and he's an adult working and stuff. But although a young guy, like just a young guy, and look at that statue, it's incredible looking. What a talented guy.
It really was.
whose name is kind of unknown, you know? I think it's a good mission to try and make sure his name is better known. It's a huge statue. The statues are twice human sized. It's incredible that they built this thing. You know, I think this is like sort of the age of like, this is post, you know, D.W. Griffith, and, you know, Intolerance, where he rebuilt Babylon practically. They did spend some money on sets back in the day, and this is definitely pre-union, so I think it was maybe a little bit cheaper to build big sets than it was once Yahtzee and everything, you know, was established, obviously, and you have to pay people a decent wage and can't work them 7 days a week, but, you know, which is good, but I'm just saying. But this is one of my favorite moments in the movie where, you know, Christine and Raoul are up on top of the roof. And they're sure they're alone, and they're sure they escaped the Phantom, and they're talking. She's telling them about the Phantom, and they're talking about how ugly he is, and talking about what his plans are. And it pans up, and the Phantom is there on the statue above them, staring down, and his cloak is just immensely huge and blowing in the wind like Batman and stuff. It's an incredible shot, but I find it so creepy that this guy, he's taking the skull mask off, and you see his actual face, and he's spying on them, and it's just so. And he gets so upset that he gives himself away. He's like, she's broke my heart. It's just amazing.
Yeah. And it's another scene where, I mean, he truly brings out the sympathy and the empathy
yes.
from the audience to the character.
Mm-hmm.
There is a line, and I forget who has said it, so I apologize, but in that documentary I was telling you about, there's a line that someone said about Lon Chaney, and then I hadn't thought of it like this before, but it makes so much sense. We're talking about how Chaney wasn't so apt or so prone to overact the way that a lot of silent film stars did. So, I mean, he mm-hmm. did at times, but more or less, you know, overall, he didn't. This person said, you know, Lon Chaney understood that his face was 50 foot big on a theater screen, and he didn't have to do that.
So neat. Yeah, right.
And the look on the Phantom's face here. So even under the makeup and you know you see his this living skull face. I mean, just the heartbreak that is on his face when
yes.
as he says, you know, she's betrayed me. That will tug at your heartstrings, even if you just straight don't yeah. like the guy.
He's brokenhearted. Whether he has kind of a right to be or not, okay, I mean, arguable. But yeah, no, he's genuinely heartbroken. You know, it's interesting, this being a silent film, I can't even imagine that given those dentures that he was wearing, that anything Chaney said could – I wonder if you could have recorded sound on set when he's doing these lines. I wonder if he would have sounded clear, or if his speech would have been impeded by – you know, it's like when you put in fake vampire fangs and you're like, you know.
Yeah.
I just wonder about this. So if it had been sound, I wonder if they would have had to dub all his dialogue, or he would not have been able to use those teeth. He would have had to scale them back
yeah.
or do something that would have enabled. I'm sure he would have figured out something brilliant had he needed to do that. I'm just saying, like, yeah, it's a weird artifact of the silent era that he could do these crazy teeth like that, and then, you know, now you would have the guy speak with the teeth and not be able to speak, and you would go in a looping stage and have him match all his dialogue, or her, or whomever, you know. So he doesn't sound like a kid wearing plastic yeah. vampire fangs.
One thing that I discovered, and I didn't realize this, I actually discovered reading there's a newer book about London After Midnight, is that in a lot of silent movies they would actually have music playing while they shot scenes to kind of like set the mood.
That's neat.
And I that was news to me.
That's really cool.
I had not heard that
nice.
Before.
There's literally some guy with like a Victrophone, like,
yeah,
putting the needle down,
or an organ, or
turning
something,
the
yeah.
funnel, you know, or that. Yeah, yeah. Maybe someone actually playing on set or something. That's really interesting. There's a moment here I do think is funny, where, you know, underneath the Phantom, So Raoul says, like, okay, I'm going to be there with my carriage tomorrow night, and you're going to perform. And when you're done, I'm taking you to England. So they've hatched a plan to get her away and to take her to safety. And then, you know, they embrace. And I mean, for all the world, it kind of looks like Norman Carey is trying to kiss Mary Philbin. And it looks like Mary Philbin is like trying to not let him do it. It looks like she's like again, the story of that she was very uncomfortable with intimacy on the
yeah.
set. It looks like she's kind of giving. There's a moment where he puts his arm around her waist, and she kind of takes it and moves it away from her waist. I just think it's kind of a funny moment. Like, I think you're seeing a little bit of the actual actor through the character a bit. It's funny.
Yeah,
it comes off like it's an era, and she has a sense of propriety or whatever, and they're not married, so, you know, she's, you know, it sells within the context of the movie. I'm just saying, knowing what I have known or have learned about her, like, yeah, she's like, all right, hands off, bud, not till the wedding.
Young Frankenstein, yeah.
Wait,
Madeline gone, yeah. Wait until we're married.
Wait until we're married. That's so funny. Do a shot, everybody.
Yeah, Mel Brooks.
The next night, yeah, they put Faust on again. But I do want to say, like, that shot looking up at him on the statue of Apollo with this thing, that actually is my favorite shot of the film. I just think it's the most architecturally, it looks like a Bernie Wrightson illustration. Like, it's incredible looking. It's just so cool. So yeah, the next night they do put on Faust again, ignoring the Phantom's warnings, obviously. Raoul shows up in his carriage. He's ready to take her away, but she has to do the performance. For some reason, they've decided that she does have to do this one. I guess maybe it's going to be her final performance. So she's like, let me do it. But, you know, there's just this idea of like the show must go on, you know, it's an interesting, this film being so based in the thing.
It does make you wonder why they did this plan. I mean, I guess if Christine is still attached to the opera, but I don't know, even if I was this, you know, like really popular and in demand, like actor on Broadway or something,
yeah,
and I experienced something like this, I probably wouldn't wait for the next performance to skip town.
I'd get kidnapped by the
Yeah, band, I'd though. Just leave. Like, why?
That's why they wait till the next. You are not an actor.
Yes, true. That's exactly why.
I forgot to mention that as they're going back from the roof, they go down, they run into Ladue, and this is about the second or third time Raoul and Ladue have had, it might be Ladeau, I don't know. This is about the second or third time they've run into each other. And again, Raoul's not really sure what to make of him, but Ladue says like, no, go that way, not that
yeah.
way. So he steers them away from where, the Phantom is going to be. The next night they're putting on Faust. This is the point where the Phantom, you know, the stagehands are back there and the Phantom drugs them, you know, he switches their beers out or whatever like that. So they're going to get knocked out. And during the performance, he makes the lights go out. And when the lights go back on, Christine is gone from the center stage. So, you know, just the boldness of like, he kidnaps her right in the middle of the performance, right in the middle of the stage with 1,000 people watching. It's just, you know, that's his. You know, one of the things I was reading in research to this, you know, refers to him as an anti-villain, which is interesting because we all kind of know what an anti-hero is, right? He's a hero that does some questionable things in the service of whatever, like, so anybody from the Punisher to Jack Bauer to whatever, right?
Right.
He's not Sir Lancelot. He doesn't fit the mold of a virtuous hero quite. But his goals are okay. The converse of that, there's such a thing as an anti-villain in literature, which is ostensibly a villainous character who yet has some kind of nobility to them or some redeeming factor. And that's technically what the Phantom falls in, you know, the definition of the Phantom falls into. But aside from that, the idea of the Phantom, and again, I think I said this on the 1943 thing, is like, I mean, I love the Wolfman movies and I love the Lawrence Talbot character and everything like that. I don't know if there's a moment where I like kind of wish I was Lawrence Talbot though, because obviously his life kind of sucks, right? Hence wanting to die. But there's a bit of a moment where you're like, it would actually, I mean, it wouldn't be cool to be facially disfigured, but it would be cool to be the Phantom. It would be cool to wear the cloak and you know, run around the opera house and be, everyone's afraid of you and you get to, you know, scare people and you get to be a shadow and, steal food and like you get the idea, like where the way he lives is kind of romantically cool, like
yeah.
You're like, oh, that part of it's kind of neat, and then you admire him because he's so clever and brave and he disappears and appears, and again, like I said, he kidnaps Christina right in the middle of a performance, that just, you know, the daring of him, like you're like, oh, he's like kind of mutated Zorro, right? Like he's cool, like But this is where we actually see, I was ahead of myself, that's from another version I know I've seen. This is where we see about Eric, born during the Boulevard Massacre, educated, Devil's Island, criminal, insane, escape, yada, yada. So he's kidnapped her, and this is where finally Ladeau and Raoul team up, and Ladeau's like, I will take you, you know, to her, and he shows them how to get through the secret passage in the mirror, where the mirror, you know, the little trick door where the mirror comes apart, and they get to go into the catacombs as well. And then meanwhile, Raoul's brother, the actual count, is looking for Raoul too, because now Raoul's disappeared. So there's this whole kind of B thing happening where, you know, yeah. Raoul and Ladeau are going after the thing, and then his brother's kind of, his older brother's kind of coming back and is not long for this
no,
world.
No, he is not.
I like the scene where they're in the catacombs, and suddenly this face comes out of the darkness towards them.
Yeah.
And they pause, and the guy comes over, and he says he's a messenger from the shadows. He has nothing to do with anything with the Phantom. He has nothing to do with anything. We never see him before. We never see him again. It's just this idea that, like, maybe the Phantom's not the only weird thing living down here in the bowels of the Opera House, which I just love. I love that world, right?
So it took me a long, long time before I kind of figured out what this person was, because, like, in the old VHS print that I had, like, I could tell that, like, he was walking kind of, like, weird, and then you see Ledoux and Raoul kind of look down, and then they, like, look in horror and look at each other, and I'm like, what is it? And I think he's the rat chaser, or there's just a bunch of, yes, like, rats around him. You know, that was exploited a little bit more in the – or not exploited, but shown a little bit more in the Hammer version with Herbert Long. But
yes, yeah. But with Herbert Long, there's the very significant character, yeah, who's the rat catcher. Yeah.
And so, yeah, there's just – that's – but it's so creepy.
I've always thought of him as the rat catcher too. It's funny.
It's creepy because you don't see anything but this head walking towards yes, them, because it's so dark, and it's just this older man's face, and that's the only thing that's illuminated. And
yeah,
just randomly he's there. He's like, turn back here or you'll perish. And he was almost right.
It's so cool.
Yeah.
It's the world of this thing, because that's the other thing. Is like, not only would it be cool to be a Phantom, it would be cool to live in this world too. Like, you know, okay, like, probably kind of damp and smelly, but okay.
Moldy.
It's kind of like the Beauty and the Beast TV show from the 80s with Linda Hamilton and Ron Perlman, where, you know, underneath the city of New York, there's this whole world of people who live underground and then a culture that you have never seen, and they have their own rules and laws and stuff. It's just, I always thought it was really cool. I mean, that show got a little melodramatic for me as well at the time. I haven't watched it since. I don't even know if it's available, but, like, I mean, the two things I remember it having going for it was Ron Perlman looked freaking cool as the Beast, and that whole underground world thing. And that's kind of what I dig about this thing too. The messenger from the shadows. And of course, Raoul and Ledoux are walking around doing this thing where they have their arms straight out and their elbow bent at a 90-degree angle, and their finger pointing the thing, and it's like you're carrying a gun, right? It's like they're carrying a pistol pointing at the sky, and they're both walking like this, and it looks ludicrous. I mean, the fun part of it is it looks silly, but there's a very practical reason for it, again, so that the Phantom can't come up behind them and throw a noose around their neck and kill them. But I love the moment where Raoul's kind of distracted. He looks away and he drops his hand, and Ledoux's like, what are you doing? Get your you fool. It's so funny. Like, it's so, and he says it's a matter of life and death. There's a big deal of this made in the book as well. So they're looking for him. And they fall into this room. They fall through a trap. They go through a trap door and they fall into this room. And it's the mirror room. And it's an old torture room that ostensibly dates back to the revolution, and I in my mind it kind of ties into, like, the Marquis de Sade and stuff. Like, there's this idea of, like, people would be put in this room and I don't know if it probably explained it a little bit better in the books. There's all these mirrors and it's set in, like, this tropical kind of looking thing, and there's sand and everything, so it looks like you're on a tropical island. And then it starts getting hot behind the mirrors, and hotter and hotter, to the point where, like, it'll cook you. And there are actual two nooses in the room that are there for if you're trapped in that room, if you decide to just, you know, rather than roast to death, to end your life. Which is, you know, it kind of goes in with the hanging theme with the Phantom and stuff, but it's just so, it's Machiavellian. And, you know, the Phantom just has this thing, and he's like, oh yeah, there they are, you know, cooking in the room.
Yeah, and it kind of brings to light, you know, what we talked about earlier, which was where they talk about Eric or the Phantom, you know, where he lives where he himself was tortured, you know, many years ago.
So who knows? Yeah.
So he probably does. I mean, that's the case. He probably intimately knows these all these tricks and torture chambers.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Meanwhile, you know, the Phantom is talking with Christine and stuff. And this is, I have a note about this. And I do think, like, you know, their relationship exists mostly in his mind. Like, Christine has Christine isn't really in the relationship with him. He's in a relationship all of his own imagination with her, where in his mind, they're, you know, soulmates. And she just hasn't, you know, again, like it's like stalker behavior practically. But you know, he said, he tells her she belongs to him. And I made a note, like, seriously, like the idea, like someone belongs to you because you gave them singing lessons, really? Like this is, but this is how his mind works, right? Yeah, he made her kind of popular, but basically he just gave her a bunch of singing lessons. And he's like, well, now you're tied to me forever. Yeah. Like, just doesn't seem like a good deal. It just doesn't seem to follow the logic. So, you know. Raoul's brother, the Count, I should get his name better. Philippe. His name's Philippe. Philippe de Chenier. His brother, the Count, has reached the underground cistern kind of part, and the Phantom has a little clapper thing that warns him whenever someone's trespassing.
The clapper.
Saw it earlier when the Phantom actually got there. Yeah, he's got the clapper. Yeah. It's like, uh-oh. And here's the scene where we're talking about earlier with the underwater thing where he gets his little pipe, like snorkel, walks in there and kind of takes his cloak off, takes his mask off, so he's got his plain face. And walks down and gets underwater, and then basically walks underwater using the snorkel to breathe, and goes, and Philippe has gotten into a boat to try and find his brother, and the Phantom kind of comes up from under the water and grabs him and pulls him in the water, and we don't see him drown, but I guess the idea is that he drowns him. So
strangled, drown in the water because he it's kind of a creepy scene the way it's done and the way it's shot, because when the way the camera focuses in on Philippe's, you know, face, is he kind of like looks down and you see that Cheney's hands slowly come up and grab it, and he screams. And then like the very next shot is the water is completely still and you just see the snorkel moving away. It's like, ooh.
I know. It's like Jaws, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, it's kind of like the ending of Friday the 13th too. Now that I think about it, that's interesting. While the Phantom is away killing Philippe, it turns out this heated room is really right next to practically the Phantom's apartments, and they're shouting and Christine hears them, and he's trying to get Christine to find some keys to get him free. Thing that, because the heat hasn't been turned on yet, because the Phantom isn't aware they're there yet. But once the Phantom comes back after drowning Philippe, and she tries to sort of secretly get the keys, he catches her, and that's when he turns on the heat, and the guys start kind of cooking, and she has to plead for their lives, for the Phantom to have mercy on them. It's real. I mean, it's a lot of melodrama. And it's good melodrama. It's definitely of the period. And, you know, it's something that I get how sometimes like a younger person looks at stuff like this and goes, you know, okay. Is this the same actual medium as the movies I watch and the cartoons I watch and stuff? I get it. It's because we're, you know, and this is the oldest film. This is almost the oldest film we've done. We did Nosferatu from 22, right?
21.
So this is 25. Yeah. So this is almost 100 years old. Yeah. Wow.
98 years old, which is, it's strange. I remember, being a kid and thinking, like how far away it seemed for any of these movies to be 100 years old. And now we're, Dracula's 92 years old and so on and so forth. So it's.
Right on, yeah. The times goes on, but yeah, no, it is. It's we're very far removed from the era in which and the culture in which this film was made. And even, this film was made in 1922, but it's set in 1888, so it's a period piece.
It is
itself, yeah. As old as it is, the story it's set in is like 150 years old. So anyway, this is an amazing. I just as a filmmaker, I just want to say that the shot in the mirror room is amazing because it's a room covered in mirrors and you never see the camera reflected in it. So, I mean, the camera's kind of bunned down, and I think there's like a fake tree right dead center so that you can't see the thing, but there's not just a camera filming in a movie. There's people behind the camera, there's technicians and there's lighting and stuff like that. So to be able to shoot this whole thing and never catch anything you're not supposed to in the thing, that had to, you know,
yeah,
be something they had to be very aware of. So, and they do it.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Joseph's brother, Joseph, the guy who was hung, the hanged, I should say, the set designer. There's this kind of like C story now where like he's somehow figured out where the Phantom's dwellings are. And is it through the fact that that's how, because when they find Joseph's body, they say that he found this secret passage, and they know where the secret passage is, and they say it's finding this that caused the Phantom to kill him. So
yeah.
Joseph, who maybe wants revenge, Joseph's brother, who wants revenge on Joseph.
Simon. Is his brother.
Simon, yeah. Simon Bouquet, yeah. Simon wants revenge. He basically sort of like stirs up the crowd because, you know, you need a mob. And says, we're going to go take care of the Phantom. And they do. They start like descending into the basements of the opera house. So you know, now there's like a couple parallel stories going on.
And that is one area where I think the 1925 version makes a little bit more sense for this particular scene, because they have Joseph's death, as we talked about, much earlier than the more often seen 1929 version. But the fact that Simon now says, I've discovered his hiding place. You know, in the 29 version, Joseph's death is discovered right before Christine is abducted. And so there's only a handful of scenes between that and then Simon saying, oh, I've discovered his hiding place. One puts enough time.
Here the logic falls down a little bit.
This one puts enough time in between those two
events. What's Simon
been
doing for a few days?
Yeah. So it makes it a little bit more plausible or more believable. And
that's true. That makes sense.
I'm pretty sure I've called this out before, but if not, I'm going to now. Gibson Galland, who leads the mob to hunt down and eventually kill Eric the Phantom, is also one of the villagers standing over the body of Lon Chaney Jr. in The Wolfman. So he didn't like the Chaney guys, I guess. He killed them, helped kill them both.
Oh, yeah, right. He's at the end after Claude Rains clubs him.
Yeah, so there's a scene where, there's a still where Talbot's dead on the ground, and then Claude Rains and Warren William are kneeling there, and there's a guy with some bushy eyebrows, no beard, and a hat and torch, and he's kind of looking there, and that is Gibson Gallon.
Oh. Wow, yeah, he did. He sort of worked with two generations of that family. You know, you were talking about, and I neglected to mention this, I'm sure most people listening know this, but we were talking about Chaney's subtlety and physical performances as he's acting. Both of Chaney's parents were deaf. So he grew up having to communicate with his parents, as a child, having to communicate to his parents through sign language and through body language. So, you know, there's obviously kind of a hypothesis where you can say, like, very early on, he learned how to communicate things without words very clearly, and obviously, you know, turns that into a career in which that's exactly what he does in all his films.
And even his mom, I think, came down with rheumatism, and so she couldn't sign. You know, she couldn't use her hands, and so they, like, Chaney would have to like act out or convey like stories about what was happening or what was going on, and would.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
Or she would communicate through him, essentially just through the eyes, you know. And so he was able to pick up on a lot of that stuff, and from a very early age, definitely.
That's so wild. Yeah, no, it's what an interesting thing. Chaney ever do a sound film?
Yeah, he did one sound film. It was a sound remake of The Unholy Three.
He did.
It was in 1930.
Oh, that's right. He did the remake with Todd Browning. Mm-hmm. That's right. I've seen the sound one. I'm not sure if I've seen the sound one. I'd like to track that. You know, you wonder, like, what did Lon Chaney sound like?
Well, he sounds like his son, or vice versa. His son sounds like him. That's what I.
Oh, that's very interesting.
I kind of laugh when Lon Chaney Jr.'s, one of his criticisms is, oh, you know, I don't like his accent. You know, don't like it the way he's that Midwestern American accent. I'm like, well, if you watch the sound version of The Unholy Three, his father has the exact same dialect, and it's strange to one to see Lon Chaney Jr.'s or hear Lon Chaney Sr.'s voice, but then to close your eyes and you can hear how close their voices were
Pretty unique. That's really interesting. Yeah. So not only would the Phantom not be able to be understood through his fake teeth, but he'd also have he'd sound like he was from Kansas. I am the Phantom. Maybe it's good. It's a silent film. Who knows? And unfortunately, Chaney eventually got throat cancer, right? Yeah. That's what eventually he died of. Yeah. So, I mean, it went on for a while. He didn't just get it. And then, I think he had treatments, and I think I believe he had a laryngectomy at some point. I think they did have to take out some of his, he definitely lost his voice towards the end of, which is, he was up for, obviously. I assume almost everybody that listens to podcast knows these films almost as well as we do, if not better, but I always do want to make sure that so Lon Chaney was up for the role of Dracula when they were going to do Dracula in 31, and then he got sick and obviously was not going to be able to do it. And then I think he got better for a bit, and they thought maybe it was going to happen, and then he dies, right?
Yeah, I know he did. I think the reports were he was improving, and then a day or so later, he hemorrhaged and died. I know he was. Yeah. He's always associated with Dracula. I'm of the belief personally that he was not that Universal wouldn't have wanted him, because of course they would. I just don't think he would have done it.
Right.
He was locked into a contract with MGM.
Agree.
He wanted nothing to do with Universal.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that it would have
happened. I do think that was more like the PR department making it more of a selling a story. Yeah, I agree.
It would be interesting. Well.
He wouldn't have been able to.
Had he actually done Dracula, it would have been nothing like what we got, because he would have kept it again close to the book. He would have done what Christopher Lee longed to do for a decade and a half of Hammer, which is I want to do what Bram Stoker did. That's what I want to do for Dracula. That's exactly what Lon Chaney would have done. He would have been the, ugly, decrepit old man, this, very attractive Rudolph Valentino like suave European Bela Lugosi. So.
Yeah. Yeah. More like Gary Oldman in the beginning of the Francis Ford Coppola film. Yeah, more or less. Although tangent, Lee finally did do that one version of Dracula where he had the big mustache, which is more in keeping actually with the book too. That Dracula has this big mustache.
Yeah, with Herbert Lom as Van Helsing, actually, in that role, that version. I forget who directed that one.
See
who directed.
See, we do see movies besides Universal movies, you guys. That's not just Franco, is it?
Yes, yes, you're right. That is.
Is that? That's the Franco one. Yeah. Yeah, 1970 or something, I want to say.
I'm not sure. It's early to mid-70s.
So
the Phantom.
So the Phantom. We're back to the Phantom, everybody. Thank you. There's a moment where the Phantom is so frustrated with Christine about trying to steal his keys and free whatever that his violence almost turns on her. He raises his fist to her, And so this is this thing where you get the idea, the Phantom is not... He's not redeemable. I mean, he has aspirations to be better, but at the end of the day, the damage done to him in his life or whatever is too great. And he's just going to be, the Phantom's going to Phantom, at the end of the day.
That's a shirt.
But he gives her this choice. He gives her this Sophie's choice where there's this case and there's what is it? It's like there's a beetle and a grasshopper, or an ant and a grasshopper.
Scorpion and a grasshopper.
Scorpion and a grasshopper. Yeah, I don't know bugs. Whatever. he gives her the option. He says, you can, which is it's a weird option. It's like you can turn the one and be with me forever, but your lover and everybody will be freed, or you can turn the other one and just blow the whole place up. And for a minute, she almost reaches for the grasshopper, right? She almost blows the place up. It's like she's so desperate. She's like, whatever, fine. But I mean, obviously that would kill Raoul as well.
And
so
based off of,
I'm not sure what the,
based off of the Phantom's reaction as she almost turns the scorpion, he was.
Oh yeah. For a minute, he's like, holy shit, she's going to do it.
Yeah, I know. And I mean, there's been nothing, everything that he's done thus far would lead you to believe that he's telling her the truth, that he really does have this rig to blow up.
Yeah. So, there's obviously a ticking clock because the guys are burning alive practically. And it's great shots of like Raoul and Ledoux are like, they're just walking back and forth, like taking off like their ties and their vests and stuff. Just like, oh, they're just so bad. But, it's Ledoux who figures out that there's a little tiny, spring hole in the bottom, underneath the sand in the bottom of this trap, which is apparently, I guess it's designed so that if you're the one trying to trap someone and you accidentally get trapped in your own thing, that you have a means of getting out. It's this tiniest little thing that he finds. This is a detail in the book too, I believe. And he pulls it and he gets out of it. But they only escape. They escape into a place that's cooler, but they escape down to the thing that has all the barrels full of gunpowder that the Phantom keeps, again, in preparation to just blowing the whole thing up. Like, yeah. He's got like a doomsday backup scenario, yeah. In place,
a doomsday
right?
Bunker.
Just in case. For things get really bad. I think it's this idea of like, if the Phantom, if he realizes he's going down, he's taking everybody with him. He has that kind of a thing. It's a note that I have here at the bottom of the towards the end of the film, like, but down in this thing, like, the Phantom's a guy who has no place in the world of man based on the way he looks. He's been rejected and cast out. So he's created his own world down here, and his world down here is fine as long as the world up top doesn't interfere with it. But now with the mob coming down into the basements with, Raoul and everybody and Ledoux down there, his world's destroyed down here. So now he has no place to go. So like, it makes sense. His desperation at the end, like, everything's closing in on him and his options become more and more limited.
More desperate.
And he grows more and more desperate. Yeah. Cause he even looks out, he hears the mob coming and he looks out and he sees them all coming and there's a hole, he's like, the jig's up. So he finally agrees based on what she tells him to do that he'll pull the thing and he'll open the thing and he lets Raoul and Ledoux up and he sees, this is that moment you're talking about where he sees them together. Right.
So skip the part where she turns the grasshopper and then all the water.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. She turns the grass, but so it's a double cross because then all the water leaks out from the
lake and
into the room that the guys are in. So it puts out the gunpowder, but it's going to drown them.
It's such a great one. It's a great trick of the Phantom. And two, the way that this is shot, I mean, it's so real because, the water, it's huge stream of water that comes flowing in and it fills up so fast. and it just almost overtakes and covers, the actors there. And it's like, whew, that. When they shot that scene, I'm sure that Norman Carey and, Arthur Carew are probably thinking, am I going to drown?
Yeah, it is fast. It's crazy. And I don't even know what safety measures they had in place to keep that from happening. I think it's sped up. I think it's under cranked. So the water is like rising on film a little faster than it did in real life, but it really does rise fast. So I don't know what their option was. I mean, it's not like they could have had scuba guys ready or anything.
I'm assuming that the top was that could easily open up or
movable or something. There would have to be something. Safety measures not being what they are now, but still, I mean, you can't,
they're probably non-existent back then.
But and then as I said, Christine does convince the Phantom to let them live. Christine, by the way, this whole time she's still dressed as Esmeralda. So she's still dressed in this like German blouse and corset and everything. Yeah. And, but her hair is finally down and free and really cool looking. But, it's funny that like, maybe like if you got caught up in like this action movie and you happen to still be dressed in your Halloween costume the entire time. But we don't question it. We go like, okay. No.
To me, that's just a normal Tuesday, but
Yeah, right. Of course. You know, the problem now is that with the lake drained, the mob can actually reach the Phantom's lair because the water's only, if it's even there, it's like knee deep or what have you. So, it's like waist deep. You see them like, you know, walking through it. So the Phantom has to, the Phantom has to escape. And again, this is the moment where he sees her holding, Raoul. And he wants to take her away, and then he does take her away. That's right. I've lost my train of thought here at the end of the movie. So he's got an escape route through his bedroom.
Yes.
And okay. And here's where, that's right. So as I said before, Raoul has his carriage and driver waiting for him, to get away with Christine after the play's done.
This is where you can tell the endings are the two endings of the film are like kind of intersect because the water comes in and, Christine presumably hears their screams from below. And, up to now, the Phantom's been very brutal and pretty vicious and just dead set in killing. But she tells him, she goes, "I'll do anything you say if you just let him go." And
yeah,
I think this would have happened, after. So there's a still where the Phantom's kind of a little bit leaning over. He's got his arms outstretched and she's got her hand on his hand and it looks like she's about to just kiss his cheek. And that's kind of what happens, you know, where she shows him love and shows him care. And I think that would have happened right before the scene because it's kind of out of character from what we've seen.
Because that'd be the place.
She says, you know, "I'll just let him go and I'll do what you want." And he just says, "Okay." And then he moves the rug and opens up the door and he pulls them out. And then it kind of goes back to, you know, he has a reaction to seeing her and Raoul, you know, embrace each other. And then you get the mob coming down into where the lake once was. And then the, as you call it, the clapper starts going off and the Phantom hears all the screams. Yes. And then he goes into escape mode.
Right. So so now we're into this alternate ending. So is this a reshoot? Did they actually film the one version and say, okay, the movie's done, and then put it together and everyone goes, hang on.
Yeah.
So this whole bit is a reshoot, which is really interesting.
The whole thing of so everything from the mob coming down, was all a reshoot. All of the part of, you know, the Phantom taking Christine and going to everything from there on was a reshoot under a different director. I think and I know you mentioned his name and it's escaping me right now, but I think he was known or had done a lot of Westerns. So, which is probably why they were doing the kind of chase on the carriage there, but.
Right. Not Edward Sedgwick or someone else. There's an Ernst Lamel.
It could have been. Credited. I'm not sure. I know there's a handful. There's like two or three after Rupert Julian. I'm not sure who shot what. But yeah, I think the original was, like I said, you know, she kisses him and shows him love and he lets them go and they leave and he plays at the organ and then dies. He dies of a broken heart. And, you know, Ledoux is there's that still of him hunched over backwards, which honestly, that looks painful he's hunched over, but he's.
That does. I've always thought that that still is like, man. Yeah. Hard. Talk about suffering for your art.
Yeah.
I mean, that's cool, but, or you could have a car chase at the end of the movie. So, which is what we get, which I love for many reasons. Cause we have been, and again, like I said, like we've been inside the opera house this entire time, almost with very few exceptions. We get out like to the prefect's office and sometimes when the mob's out running around and stuff, we see a little bit of the Universal back lot and that's about it. So there's like this kind of like joy of like when the Phantom takes Christine and he takes her up out to the carriage, and he tosses the sleeping carriage driver off the thing quite violently, and escapes with the carriage. We get to see like this great, you know, suddenly we're outside. Oh my gosh, this is so wild. And we're racing through nighttime Paris. And when, once the carriage tips over, we also get to see, I mean, I just love that he, it's set in Paris, so it makes sense. He runs in front of the facade of Notre Dame from Hunchback of Notre Dame from his last movie. He literally, it's like if Indiana Jones ran past Jabba's palace. Like, well, Harrison Ford's like just running past his last movie. Like it makes total sense.
The Temple of Doom where he's at Club Obi-Wan.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's a little reference and stuff. And I wonder if people at the time even watching went, oh, wait, that's from his life. You know, you never know. I have no idea, but I love it. I love this chase, and I love the torch. You know, I mean, we talk about prototypes. Is this the first? I mean, this is probably the. I mean, there's the mob in Hunchback of Notre Dame, but yeah. I kind of don't always see Hunchback of Notre Dame as a monster movie, though, I guess, because the Quasimodo is not really a monster. He's just a mishapen kind of character. I don't know. Like, I really think of this as, I do think of Phantom as really the prototype of like the structure of what would become the universal signature thing. And one of those things is a mob chasing everybody with torches, chasing the villain at the end of the movie. And here we have torches, yeah. Mob running through the streets of Paris at night. Yeah, it's great. And it's so wild. Christine wakes up, and she does. She sort of basically jumps out of the moving carriage to get away from him. I'm not sure. So, you know, the version I'm watching, this footage is in significantly worse shape than many parts of the rest of the film. Part of me wonders if some of these shots of the mob running are from something else as well. I don't know. It looks like different. It looks like it's from different sources. And so I don't know if it's different sources of Phantom of the Opera, or if they, again, this being a reshoot, if there was an older version of Les Miserables or something like that, if they used something from there.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure. I know the fastness of the action does not lend itself well to the way they shot the movie, and a lot of the close-ups of Phantom as he's, you know, commanding this carriage is a little blurry, a little out of focus. You can't really see a whole lot of detail outside of his face and his hands.
This is definitely blown up from a probably a 16 millimeter print, or it's a multiple generational print. There's definitely more damage on it, that the version I'm watching at least. There's definitely less detail. You really can't see the Phantom's face that well. There's definitely an undercranked thing to it. However they shot this, or however it was like recorded, or however it was like, you know, whatever. It definitely has that Keystone Cops fast motion, kind of thing, more so than the rest of the film, which I think the version I'm watching has been adjusted slightly for, because everybody, one more time, back in those days, it was not an electronic motor running the camera. It was a guy with everybody's seen, with a little handle, and he's cranking. And there's a pace at which you're supposed to crank. Like, you kind of do like one revolution per second. And that approximates the 24 frames per second of filming being exposed that we associate with how films are shot, and how we replicate motion in a lifelike way on screen. We're definitely... It looks like the Phantom is running at like 145 miles an hour.
Well, when you have an angry mob of, you know, Frenchmen after you, you might.
Yeah, right. here's the moment. I'm watching it right now where he runs right in front of the thing. He covers his face when he runs in front of that, which that actually makes me wonder if that's actually even launched.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that was. I know Chaney was dead set, always doing his own stuff. I mean, so like it was Chaney that went underwater. Yeah. It was Chaney that jumped down from the carriage and all that. So I wonder if in their haste of a reshoot, if they just got in this scene with just somebody else.
Yeah, I wonder.
Either that or perhaps something went awry with his makeup as he was running, but I'm not sure if that...
Oh, I wonder, yeah. He's halfway through and he realizes he forgot to put his teeth in. Rats. The close-ups of him, there are some decent shots of him when he's in the carriage and, you know, riding and stuff that he looks... I love that they changed this ending and shot this because he looks, you finally see that he looks like absolutely out of his mind insane.
He does.
Like, he looks like so maniacal. He's running for his life, but he's laughing the entire time. I mean, that's kind of like this performance that Chaney brought to the characters. The Phantom is unhinged, and the worse things get for him, the more he just like celebrates the awfulness. Like, he, even when he's in just a minute where he's cornered right by the River Seine, and he does this thing where he pretends he has like a bomb or something, and he realizes it's nothing, and he laughs like a maniac. Like,
it's,
I mean I guess the one thing about it is like the Phantom's not afraid to die, obviously. Like, he's going with it, but there's definitely something maniacal about him, and Chaney's performance in this is so good. It reaches like a peak here that we almost haven't seen yet, and it's just really wonderful to see.
Yes, this is one of my, probably my favorite scenes in any Lon Chaney movie ever, is the very end here. And I heard Ray Bradbury describe it like this, and I thought this was so true, which is what the Phantom does here is almost like an allegory for all of Lon Chaney's career in movies, which is he's literally scaring a mob on both sides of him that surrounded him, you know, scaring them to stop away with this threat that he has in his fist, and he's holding it up. Then he looks and he just laughs at him, and he opens his hand, and there's been nothing there the entire time, you know, and that's like I really agree with that. And I like that.
It's all an illusion. Yeah.
Yeah. Chaney spent a career in making sure that he was never, you know, it's that famous quote, you know, between pictures, there is no Lon Chaney, you know, people don't get to know me, essentially, is what he's saying. And
that is so interesting. Yeah.
You know, I think he did that intentionally just to keep the aura of mystery about him. And, you know, he really was this mysterious man of a thousand faces that nobody knows, you know, where he goes or what he does or what he did.
So interesting.
And then, you know, at the end, he's, you know, all of that stuff, all of that mystery and enigma and all the what ifs and what is he really like, and, you know, opens the hand it's nothing. You know,
it's nothing. Yeah. And Enigma, who, didn't you tell me the story, but didn't Lon Chaney give Boris Karloff a ride home sometimes when Boris Karloff was really young?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, he was...
Or something, when he was, like, struggling? Yeah, he was... So he's, like, a nice guy, but yeah.
Just as far as, like, the public eye is concerned.
From the public,
He gave very few interviews. Yeah. He didn't... There's not many autographs you know. He never... Yeah. I think he only went to a handful, maybe one or two. I'll just say a handful, because I'm not sure, of actual film premieres. Yeah. I think he went to the Marines.
Premieres for his films. That's interesting.
He was real proud of that.
Yeah.
He did a promo tour for
that's really
Hunchback of Notre Dame, just because, again, that was something that he really wanted to do and he was really proud of. One of the very few interviews with him on camera, if not the only one, and people out there can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's where Chaney is showing whoever's talking to him around the set of The Hunchback, and he actually climbs up he's just in normal clothes. It's just Lon Chaney.
Oh, that's
funny. He climbs up the side and, hops down and is doing the whole hunched over and mimicking it perfectly.
That's amazing.
And, but I mean, like, apart from that, there is no, I remember reading an interview, well, not really an interview, but he wrote an essay, I want to say in 1926, 1927, somewhere in there for a magazine, where he talks a little bit about his history and you know, what kind of about his craft and all that. The thing that always stuck out the most to me about that one is he says that, you know, my son wants to wants to get into movies, but it's nothing that he should, you know, nothing that I would want for him. he should do something else.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Chaney did not want his son to follow in his footsteps, and Lon Jr. didn't for the longest time until I think he just, yeah, it brought him back. It's like Chinatown. It sucked him back. I don't know. Raul finally, as the mob races by, Raul catches up with Christine and grabs her up. And so now she's safe with him as the mob continues to chase the Phantom to, again, as I said before, the edge of the River Seine. He runs down the stairs and he's right by the water. And then this is where he realizes he's surrounded by them. And he does his little fake out thing, which it to me, I think it's neat because it's a little callback to in the novel. In addition to all the other parts of his history, Eric the Phantom had made a living as a stage magician as well. So he had this like kind of, you know, craft as a guy who performed and created illusions for a living before going into apparently building an architecture and helping build the Paris Opera House. So this is this last bit of like, yeah, stage magic, like deception, right? And he laughs and has all this thing. You know, and he literally lifts his arms up and the mob just, you know, reaches in and grabs him and
yeah,
half the mob falls in the water.
Yeah, I know.
By mistake. But there's a little insert shot where it leans in and you see there's a guy hovering over him just punching down.
Yeah, they're clubbing him. You know,
he gets beaten. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And they beat him to death and throw him into the river.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's finally lit up and tossed in the river, which, you know, it's interesting that the version I'm watching, there's a jump cut where they lift him up. And then the next thing you see is a splash. There's actually not the shot where you see the body actually going through the air and going into the water. So that's an unfortunate lap of footage right there. It's kind of important. That's it. They throw him in and you just see the bubbles, we have a little bit of a coda about the honeymoon, and it's Raul and Christine and they're finally, you know, okay with kissing, I guess. I mean, we've seen them kiss before, but I guess, you know, the idea is they're married now and they're somewhere else in this flowery garden and stuff, which is just, you know, but as I always say, you get the feeling like their marriage is going to be complicated because it's founded on quite a bit of
trauma,
yeah. Right? You remember right before we got married when I got kidnapped by the opera ghost? Yeah, that was
like weird.
I don't think that goes away. I think that
like in the Invisible Man Returns, you know, Vincent Price and Nan Gray. He's like, you remember that time where I went crazy and tried to kill a bunch of people?
yeah, exactly. You know, trying to clear my name and this whole thing. Yeah, exactly. For sure. Guys, that is 1925's Family Opera starring Lon Chaney, Mary Philbin, directed by Rupert Julian and a whole bunch of other people. and I do believe some of the there are different edits. I think there's people who are credited as directors who kind of came on afterwards and just re-edited the footage. And then they edited back. You know, they do a version. There's a theory that up to 60% of the footage shot in this film was edited out and lost. So that, you know, in a way they're it's like there could be like a 4.5 hour version of this movie that would have multiple endings, would have multiple versions and multiple angles and what have you.
Yeah. It's a shame because I'm quite sure nothing of outside of what we already have exists of it.
Yeah.
But man, to see that would be tremendous. Of course, could have been the worst, you know, film ever. Kind of like, you know, London After Midnight, you know, anybody that ever actually saw it was kind of like, it's held in such high regard about, you know, the most famous lost film, but by all accounts, it really wasn't a great movie. It just happened to have a cool looking.
It wasn't all that great.
Vampire.
Yeah. Which is very interesting. Yeah.
But,
its legend is based on the mystery.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah,
exactly.
Just the fact that it is lost, but this will always be, the Phantom of the Opera. I do enjoy the Claude Rains movie. I've come to appreciate that more as I've gotten older. But, And I get the musical and you know, stuff like that. And I see the appeal, but I don't, there is no other Phantom outside of Lon Chaney. There's no one that has ever brought this character from Gaston LaRue's novel to life like Chaney did.
Right.
And, you know, like I said earlier, he took his craft so seriously, and he literally poured everything that he had into to these roles, and that's why you could have a character who is maniacal and insane as Eric the Phantom, and you can still feel sorry for him and still empathize with the fact that deep down he just wanted to be loved by somebody because he's been shunned by society. But you know, I think there's a reason that this is the most famous of Lon Chaney's films. I know people that are super fans of his work will argue, like, you know, hey, this guy did a whole lot of stuff that's not horror related that's really good, and which is true. But also, you know, as I say, there are reasons for everything, and you know, there's a reason why Tell It to the Marines isn't released on, you know, 85 different, you know, special edition versions. It's the Phantom of the Opera.
Why is there's not a Criterion version of it? Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, things just become all, you know, through a mix of, you know, when they came out and their topic and how they landed at the time and the zeitgeist and everything like that. Some movies just have a lasting power beyond whatever. I mean, we have, you know, it's, they think like 80% of the silent films that were made are lost now.
Yeah.
You know, what we have is a fragment of what was made. They were making a lot of movies back in this era in the teens and the 20s. And even beyond like the small amount percentage of those films that we do have, I think for these movies to still have a anything beyond like a pretty narrow appeal, means there has to be something special in them that kind of transcends the genre and the culture.
Yeah.
and a 21st century person can watch them and engage and not be distracted by the very different stylization and technique and performance and everything of the era. And when you think about that, you think about, you know, Nosferatu, Cabinet of Caligari, right? Of course, the Golem, some of the Paul Wenger stuff. Obviously Phantom of the Opera, Hunchback of Notre Dame, are Chaney's two biggest, you know, within our genre at least, but I would argue, you know, beyond that. And then it's like Chaplin, Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, you know, there's the comedy side too. But like, it's just amazing that you can watch something from another era like this that was recorded so long ago by people that have been gone for so long, and it connects on all those emotional beats in the same way as it did at that time.
Yeah.
Those things have not changed. The things we look for in a story and in characters that we gravitate to, those core things haven't changed all that much, and this film hits on all those in a way that it still has all its appeal. It's
exactly wonderful. Right. I mean, the basic needs and wants of a person, you know, whether it was 100 years ago or today, you know, regardless of technology and you know, how society is so vastly different between now and 98 years ago, but still you know, the basic desire of being accepted and being loved and finding love, you know, that's why, you know, that's why it lasts. And it's just, it's incredible to think that, you know, something like this 100 years ago is still so widely known and talked about, and just the whole image of the Phantom makeup and just his picture is so much a part of pop culture, you know.
Absolutely.
And, you know, without Lon Chaney in this movie is, I mean, there's nothing else in this movie that, I'm not saying that anyone else didn't do great. I mean, there's, you know, Arthur Edmund Carew did a fantastic job.
Right.
Gibson Gallant did pretty good. But, you know, Norman Carey and Mary Philbin are not the world's best actors. There's no way they're going to hold
a
movie.
They're typical for the era. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's Lon Chaney.
No, I think it's – and I'd argue that the reason there is an Andrew Lloyd Webber opera that made like $1 billion and, you know, the reason, you know, it is still a widely performed stage play and everything – is because of this movie. Like you said, like, I think the book would still be around and people would probably know it, but I think it's the movie that made the book as famous as it was. Similar to, you know, Dracula wasn't as huge a book when it came out. It was the stage plays and then the movie versions that made it a legend that it is. When Bram Stoker died, his obituary doesn't even mention Dracula. It mentions some of his other stuff, but that's it. So in a way, like, you know, the monsters give these things longevity and immortality, which is such a prosaic kind of thing compared to, you know, the fates they all meet at the end of these movies. Yeah. They die in the movies, but the movies make sure the characters go on and on and on. It's wonderful. So it was great to talk about this version. We, you know, obviously we did the 43 version. It's fun to go back and you know, again, talk about the template that set the standard for everything to follow with Dracula, Frankenstein, everything. So good deal. Good episode. Awesome. Everybody, this is Jim Towns. Thank you so much for listening to this long episode on Phantom of the Opera. We appreciate your listenership. We appreciate you following along on our social media pages. Please make sure you're subscribed so you get these episodes in your inbox of your preferred podcast app every other Thursday. We've got some great stuff coming up the rest of the year. We're going to be bouncing back and forth between decades, 20s, 30s, 40s, maybe 50s even. There's a little hint there. And we'll just try and keep you entertained as the year goes on. Thanks so much, Livio. Appreciate you suggesting this movie and making sure that we did it right. I hope we did.
Yeah, no, it was awesome to talk about. Thank you.
Cool. All right, everybody. Have a good night. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode. But the fun does not stop here. You can follow and interact with the show's hosts and listeners online on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. The Borgo Pass Horror Podcast is a presentation of Shadow Camera Film and Entertainment. This episode was edited by Livio Marino. The music was composed by Sean Poole. Opening and closing narration are by me, Kat Herons. Show titles and graphics created by Jim Towns. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast.